Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett. Part 7. Vimes felt curiously elated as he stepped out into the city's throbbing streets again. He was definitely detecting things. They were little bits of things, like a jigsaw. No one of them made any real sense, but they all hinted at a bigger picture. All he needed to do was to find a corner, or a bit of an edge. He was pretty certain it wasn't a wizard, whatever the librarian might think. Not a proper paid-up wizard. This sort of thing wasn't their style. And there was, of course, this business about the lair. The most sensible course would be to wait and see if the dragon turned up tonight, and try to see where. That meant a high place. Was there some way of detecting dragons themselves? He'd had a look at Cut-Me-Own-Throat Dibbler's dragon detectors, which consisted solely of a piece of wood on a metal stick. When the stick was burned through, you'd found your dragon. Like a lot of Cut-Me-Own-Throat's devices, it was completely efficient in its own special way, while at the same time being totally useless. There had to be a better way of finding the thing than waiting until your fingers were burned off. The setting sun spread out on the horizon like a likely poached egg. The rooftops of Ankh-Morpork sprouted a fine array of gargoyles even in normal times. But now they were alive with as ghastly an array of faces as ever was seen outside a woodcut about the evils of gin-drinking among the non-woodcut-buying classes. Many of the faces were attached to bodies holding a fearsome array of homely weapons that had been handed down from generation to generation for centuries, often with some force. From his perch on the roof of the watch-house, Vimes could see the wizards lining the rooftops of the university and the gangs of opportunist horde researchers waiting in the streets, shovels at the ready. If the dragon really did have a bed somewhere in the city, then it would be sleeping on the floor tomorrow. From somewhere below came the cry of Cut-Me-Own-Throat Dibbler, or one of his colleagues, selling hot sausages. Vimes felt a sudden surge of civic pride. There had to be something right about a citizenry which, when faced with catastrophe, thought about selling sausages to the participants. The city waited. A few stars came out. Colon, Nobby, and Carrot were also on the roof. Colon was sulking because Vimes had forbidden him to use his bow and arrow. These weren't encouraged in the city, since the heft and throw of a longbow's arrow could send it through an innocent bystander at 100 yards away, rather than the innocent bystander at whom it was aimed. "That's right," said Carrot. "The Projectile Weapons Civic Safety Act 1634.
"Don't you go on quoting all that sort of stuff," snapped Colon. "We don't have any of them laws any more. That's all old stuff. It's all more what's names now, pragmatic."
"Law or no law," said Vimes, "I say put it away."
"But, Captain, I was a dab hand at this," protested Colon. "Anyway," he added peevishly, "a lot of other people have got 'em."
That was true enough. Neighbouring rooftops bristled like hedgehogs. If the wretched thing turned up, it was going to think it was flying through solid wood with slots in it. You could almost feel sorry for it.
"I said put it away," said Vimes. "I'm not having my guards shooting citizens, so put it away."
"That's very true," said Carrot. "We're here to protect and serve, aren't we, Captain?" Vimes gave him a sidelong look.
He said. "Yeah, yes, that's right."
On the roof of her house, on the hill, Lady Ramkin adjusted a rather inadequate folding chair on the roof, arranged the telescope, coffee flask and sandwiches on the parapet in front of her, and settled down to wait. She had a notebook on her knee. Half an hour went by. Hails of arrows greeted a passing cloud, several unfortunate bats, and the rising moon.
"Bugger this for a game of soldiers," said Nobby eventually. "It's been scared off."
Sergeant Colon lowered his pike.
"Looks like it," he conceded.
"And it's getting chilly up here," said Carrot. He politely nudged Captain Vimes, who was slumped against the chimney, staring moodily into space.
"Maybe we ought to be getting down, sir," he said. "Lots of people are."
"Hm?" said Vimes, without moving his head.
"Could be coming into rain, too," said Carrot.
Vimes said nothing. For some minutes he had been watching the Tower of Art, which was the centre of Unseen University and reputedly the oldest building in the city. It was certainly the tallest. Time, weather, and indifferent repairs had given it a gnarled appearance, like a tree that has seen too many thunderstorms. He was trying to remember its shape. As in the case with many things that are totally familiar, he hadn't really looked at it for years. Now he was trying to convince himself that the forest of little turrets and crenellations at its top looked just the same tonight as they had done yesterday. It was giving him some difficulty. Without taking his eyes off it, he grabbed Sergeant Colon's shoulder and gently pointed him in the right direction. He said, "Can you see anything odd about the top of the tower?" Colon stared up for a while and then laughed nervously.
"Well, it looks like there's a dragon sitting on it, doesn't it?"
"Yeah, that's what I thought.
Only when you sort of look properly, you can see it's just made up out of shadows and clumps of ivy and that. I mean, if you half close one eye, it looks like two women in a wheelbarrow."
Vimes tried this. "Nope," he said. "It still looks like a dragon. A huge one. Sort of hunched up and looking down. Look, you can see its wings folded up."
"Beg your pardon, sir. That's just a broken turret giving that effect."
They watched it for a while.
Then Vimes said, "Tell me, Sergeant. I ask in the spirit of pure inquiry, what do you think's causing the effect of a pair of huge wings unfurling?" Colon swallowed.
"I think that's caused by a pair of huge wings, sir," he said.
"Spot on, Sergeant." The dragon dropped.
It wasn't a swoop. It simply kicked away from the top of the tower and half fell, half flew straight downward, disappearing from the view behind the university buildings. Vimes caught himself listening for the thump. And then the dragon was in view again, moving like an arrow, moving like a shooting star, moving like something that has somehow turned a 32 feet per second plummet into an unstoppable upward swoop. It glided over the rooftops at a little more than head height, all the more horrible because of the sound. It was as though the air was slowly and carefully being torn in half. The watch threw themselves flat. Vimes caught a glimpse of huge, vaguely horse-like features before it slid past.
"Sodden arseholes," said Nobby from somewhere in the guttering.
Vimes redoubled his grip on the chimney and pulled himself upright.
"You are in uniform, Corporal Nobbs," he said in a voice hardly shaking at all.
"Sorry, Captain. Sodden arseholes, sir."
"Where's Sergeant Colon?"
"Down here, sir. Holding on to the drainpipe, sir."
"Oh, for goodness sake, help him up, Carrot."
"Gosh," said Carrot, "look at it go."
You could tell the position of the dragon by the rattle of arrows across the city and by the screams and gurgles of all those hit by the misses and ricochets.
"He hasn't even flapped his wings yet," shouted Carrot, trying to stand on the chimney pot. "Look at him go."
It shouldn't be that big, Vimes told himself, watching the huge shape wheel over the river.
"It's as long as a street."
There was a puff of flame above the docks, and for a moment the creature passed in front of the moon. Then it flapped its wings, once, with a sound like the damp hides of a pedigree herd being slapped across a cliff. It turned in a tight circle, pounded the air a few times to build up speed, and came back. When it passed over the watchhouse, it coughed up a column of spitting white fire. Tiles under it didn't just melt, they erupted in red-hot droplets. The chimney stack exploded and rained bricks across the street. Vast wings hammered at the air as the creature hovered over the burning building, fire spearing down in what rapidly became a glowing heap. Then, when all that was left was a spreading puddle of melted rock with interesting streaks and bubbles in it, the dragon raised itself with a contemptuous flick of its wings and soared away upward over the city. Lady Ramkin lowered her telescope and shook her head slowly.
"That's not right," she whispered. "That's not right at all. Shouldn't be able to do anything like that."
She raised the lens again and squinted, trying to see what was on fire. Down below, in their long kennels, the little dragons howled. Traditionally, upon waking from a blissfully uneventful insensibility, you ask, "Where am I?" It's probably part of the racial consciousness or something. Vimes said it. Tradition allows a choice of second lines. A key point in the selection process is an audit to see that the body has all the bits it remembers having yesterday. Vimes checked. Then comes the tantalizing bit. Now that the snowball of consciousness is starting to roll, it is going to find that it's waking up inside a body lying in a gutter with something multiple. The noun doesn't matter after an adjective like multiple. Nothing good ever follows multiple. Or is it going to be a case of crisp sheets, a soothing hand, and a businesslike figure in white pulling open the curtains on a bright new day? Is it all over, with nothing worse to look forward to now than weak tea, nourishing gruel, short strengthening walks in the garden, and possibly a brief platonic love affair with a ministering angel. Or was this all just a moment's blackout, and some looming bastard is now about to get down to real business with the thick end of a pickaxe helve? Are there, the consciousness wants to know, going to be grapes? At this point, some outside stimulus is helpful. It's going to be all right is a favourite, whereas did anyone get his number is definitely a bad sign. Either, however, is better than you two hold his hands behind his back. In fact, someone said,
"You were nearly a goner there, Captain."
The pain sensation, which had taken advantage of Vimes's unconscious state to bunk off for a metaphorical quick cigarette, rushed back. Vimes said, "Ah!" Then he opened his eyes. There was a ceiling. This ruled out one particular range of unpleasant options, and was very welcome. His blurred vision also revealed Corporal Nobbs, which was less so. Corporal Nobbs proved nothing. You could be dead and see something like Corporal Nobbs. Ankh-Morpork did not have many hospitals. All the guilds maintained their own sanatoriums, and there were very few public ones run by the odder religious organisations, like the Balancing Monks. But by and large medical assistance was non-existent, and people had to die inefficiently, without the aid of doctors. It was generally thought that the existence of cures encouraged slackness, and was in any case probably against nature's way.
"Have I already said, where am I?" said Vimes faintly.
"Yes."
"Did I get an answer?"
"Dunno where this place is, Captain. It belongs to some posh bint. She said to bring you up here."
Even though Vimes's mind appeared to be full of pink treacle, he nevertheless grabbed two clues and wrestled them together. The combination of rich and up here meant something. So did the strange chemical smell in the room, which even overpowered Nobby's more everyday odours.
"We're not talking about Lady Ramkin, are we?" he said cautiously.
"You could be right. Great big biddy. Mad for dragons."
Nobby's rodent face broke into the most horribly knowing grin Vimes had ever seen.
"You're in her bed," he said.
Vimes peered around him, feeling the first overtures of a vague panic, because now that he could halfway focus, he could see a certain lack of bachelor sockness about the place. There was a faint hint of talcum powder.
"Bit of a boudoir," said Nobby, with the air of the connoisseur.
"Hang on a minute," said Vimes. "There was this dragon. It was right over us."
The memory rose up and hit him like a zombie with a grudge.
"You all right, Captain?"
The talons outspread, wide as a man's reach, the boom and thump of wings bigger than sails, the stink of chemicals, the gods know alone what sort. It had been so close, he could see the tiny scales on its legs and the red gleam in its eyes. They were more than just reptile eyes. They were eyes you could drown in. And the breath. So hot that it wasn't like fire at all, but something almost solid, not burning things, but smashing them apart. On the other hand, he was here and alive. His left side felt as though it had been hit with an iron bar, but he was quite definitely alive.
"What happened?" he said.
"It was young Carrot," said Nobby. "He grabbed you and the sergeant and jumped off the roof just before it got us."
"My side hurts. It must have got me," said Vimes.
"No, I reckon that was when you hit the privy roof," said Nobby, "and then you rolled off and hit the water butt."
"What about Colon? Is he hurt?"
"Not hurt. Not exactly hurt. He landed more sort of softly. Him being so heavy, he went through the roof. Talk about a short, sharp shower of..."
"And then what happened?"
"Well, we sort of made you comfy, and then everyone went blundering around and shouting for the sergeant, until they found out where he was, of course, and then they just stood where they was and shouted. And then this woman came running up, yelling," said Nobby.
"This is Lady Ramkin you're referring to," said Vimes coldly. His ribs were aching really magnificently now.
"Yeah, big fat party," said Nobby, unmoved. "Course you can't half-boss people around. Oh, the poor dear man, you must bring him up to my house this instant." "So we did. Best place, too. Everyone's running around down in the city like chickens with their heads cut off."
"How much damage did it do?"
"Well, after you were out of it, the wizard hit it with fireballs. It didn't like that at all, just seemed to make it stronger and angrier. Took out the university's entire Widdershins wing."
"And?"
"That's about it, really. It flamed a few more things, and then it must have flown off away in the smoke."
"No one saw where it went?"
"If they did, they ain't saying. Nobby sat back and leered. Disgusting, really, her living in a room like this. She's got pots and pots of money, Sarge says. She's got no call living in an ordinary room. What's the good of not wanting to be poor if the rich are allowed to go around living in ordinary rooms? Should be marble. He sniffed. Anyway, she said I was to fetch her when you woke up. She's feeding her dragons now. Odd little buggers, aren't they? It's amazing she's allowed to keep them.
What do you mean?
You know, tarred with the same brush and that.
When Nobby had shambled out, Vimes took another look around the room. It did indeed lack the gold leaf and marble that Nobby felt was compulsory for people of high station in life. All the furniture was old, and the pictures on the wall, though doubtless valuable, looked the sort of pictures that are hung on bedroom walls because people can't think of anywhere else to put them. There were also a few amateurish watercolours of dragons. All in all, it had the look about it of a room that is only ever occupied by one person, and has been absent-mindedly moulded around them over the years, like a suit of clothes with a ceiling. It was clearly the room of a woman, but one who had cheerfully, and without any silly moping, been getting on with her life while all that soppy romance stuff had been happening to other people somewhere else. Such clothing as was visible had been chosen for sensible hard-wearing qualities, possibly by a previous generation by the look of it, rather than its use as light artillery in the war between the sexes. There were bottles and jars neatly arranged on the dressing table, but a certain severity of line suggested that their labels would say things like "rub on nightly" rather than "just a dab behind the ears." You could imagine that the occupant of this room had slept in it all her life and had been called "my little girl" by her father until she was 40. There was a big sensible blue dressing gown hanging behind the door. Vimes knew, without even looking, that it would have a rabbit on the pocket. In short, it was the room of a woman who never expected that a man would ever see the inside of it. The bedside table was piled high with papers. Feeling guilty, but doing it anyway, Vimes squinted at them. Dragons was the theme. There were letters from the Cavern Club Exhibitions Committee, and the Friendly Flamethrowers League. There were pamphlets and appeals from the Sunshine Sanctuary for Sick Dragons. Poor little Vinny's fires were nearly dampened after 5 years' cruel use as a paint stripper, but now... And there were requests for donations and talks and things that added up to a heart big enough for the whole world, or at least that part of it that had wings and breathed fire. If you let your mind dwell on rooms like this, you could end up being oddly sad and full of a strange diffuse compassion, which would lead you to believe that it might be a good idea to wipe out the whole human race and start again with amoebas. Beside the drift of paperwork was a book. Vimes twisted painfully and looked at the spine. It said, "Diseases of the Dragon," by Sybil Deirdre Olgivana Ramkin. He turned the stiff pages in horrified fascination. They opened into a world of quite stupefying problems. Slab throat, the black tups, dry lungs, storage, staggers, heaves, weeps, stones. It was amazing, he decided after reading a few pages, that a swamp dragon ever survived to see a second sunrise. Even walking across a room must be reckoned a biological triumph. The painstakingly drawn illustrations he looked away from hurriedly. You could only take so much innards. There was a knock at the door.
"I say, are you decent?"
Lady Ramkin boomed cheerfully.
"I've brought you something jolly nourishing."
Somehow, Vimes imagined it would be soup. Instead, it was a plate stacked high with bacon, fried potatoes, and eggs. He could hear his arteries panic just by looking at it.
"I've made bread pudding too," said Lady Ramkin slightly sheepishly. "I don't normally cook much, just for myself. You know how it is, catering for one."
Vimes thought about the meals at his lodgings. Somehow, the meat was always grey, with the mysterious tubes in it. He began, not used to addressing the ladies from a recumbent position in their own beds.
"Corporal Nobbs tells me..."
"And what a colourful little man Nobby is," said Lady Ramkin.
Vimes wasn't certain he could cope with this.
"Colourful," he said weakly.
"A real character. We've been getting along famously."
"You have?"
"Oh, yes. What a great fund of anecdotes he has."
"Oh, yes. He's got that all right."
It always amazed Vimes how Nobby got along with practically everyone. It must, he'd decided, have something to do with the common denominator. In the entire world of mathematics, there could be no denominator as common as Nobby.
He said, and then found he couldn't leave this strange new byway. "You don't find his language a bit, ripe?"
"Salty," corrected Lady Ramkin cheerfully. "You should have heard my father when he was annoyed. Anyway, we've found we've got a lot in common. It's an amazing coincidence, but my grandfather once had his grandfather whipped for malicious lingering." That must make them practically family, Vimes thought. Another stab of pain from his stricken side made him wince. You've got some very bad bruising and probably a cracked rib or two, she said. If you roll over, I'll put some of this on.
Panic crossed Vimes's face. Instinctively, he raised the sheets up around his neck.
Oh, don't play silly buggers, man, she said. I shan't see anything I haven't seen before. One backside is pretty much like another. It's just that the ones I see generally have tails on. Now roll over, and up with the nightshirt. It belonged to my grandfather, you know.
There was no resisting that tone of voice. Vimes thought about demanding that Nobby be brought in as a chaperone, and then decided that would be even worse. The cream burned like ice.
What is it?
All kinds of stuff. It'll reduce the bruising and promote the growth of healthy scale.
What?
Sorry, probably not scale. Don't look so worried. I'm almost positive about that.
Okay, all done.
She gave him a slap on the rump.
Madam, I am a captain of the night watch, said Vimes,
knowing it was a bloody daft thing to say even as he said it.
Half naked in a lady's bed, too, said Lady Ramkin, unmoved. Now sit up and eat your tea. We've got to get you good and strong.
Vimes's eyes filled with panic.
Why? He said.
Lady Ramkin reached into the pocket of her grubby jacket.
I made some notes last night, she said, about the dragon.
Oh, the dragon.
Vimes relaxed a bit. Right now, the dragon seemed a much safer prospect.
And I did a bit of working out, too. I'll tell you this, it's a very odd beast. It shouldn't be able to get airborne.
You're right there.
If it's built like my swamp dragons, it should weigh about 20 tons. 20 tons! It's impossible. It's all down to weight and wingspan ratios, you see.
I saw it drop off the tower like a swallow.
I know. It should have torn its wings off and left a bloody great hole in the ground, said Lady Ramkin firmly. You can't muck about with aerodynamics. You can't just scale up from small to big and leave it at that, you see. It's all a matter of muscle power and lifting surfaces.
I knew there was something wrong, said Vimes, brightening up. And the flame, too. Nothing goes around with that kind of heat inside it. How do swamp dragons manage it?
Oh, that's just chemicals, said Lady Ramkin dismissively. They just distill something flammable from whatever they've eaten and ignite the flame just as it comes out of the ducts. They never actually have fire inside them, unless they get a case of blowback.
What happens then?
You're scraping dragons off the scenery, said Lady Ramkin cheerfully. I'm afraid they're not very well-designed creatures, dragons.
Vimes listened. They would never have survived at all except that their home swamps were isolated and short of predators. Not that a dragon made good eating anyway. Once you'd taken away the leathery skin and the enormous flight muscles, what was left must have been like biting into a badly run chemical factory. No wonder dragons were always ill. They relied on permanent stomach troubles for their supplies of fuel. Most of their brain power was taken up with controlling the complexities of their digestion, which could distill flame-producing fuels from the most unlikely ingredients. They could even rearrange their internal plumbing overnight to deal with difficult processes. They lived on a chemical knife edge the whole time. One misplaced hiccup and they were geography. And when it came to choosing nesting sites, the females had all the common sense and mothering instinct of a brick. Vimes wondered why people had been so worried about dragons in the olden days. If there was one in a cave near you, all you had to do was wait until it self-ignited, blew itself up, or died of acute indigestion.
You've really studied them, haven't you? He said.
Someone ought to.
But what about the big ones?
Golly, yes, they're a great mystery, you know, she said,
her expression becoming extremely serious.
Yes, you said.
There are legends, you know. It seems as though one species of dragon started to get bigger and bigger and then just vanished.
Died out, you mean?
No. They turned up, sometimes, from somewhere, full of vim and vigour, and then one day they stopped coming at all.
She gave Vimes a triumphant look.
I think they found somewhere where they could really be.
Really be what?
Dragons. Where they could really fulfil their potential. Some other dimension or something. Where the gravity isn't so strong or something.
I thought, when I saw it, said Vimes, I thought you can't have something that flies and has scales like that.
They looked at each other.
We've got to find its lair, said Lady Ramkin.
No bloody flying newt sets fire to my city, said Vimes.
Just think of the contribution to dragon lore, said Lady Ramkin.
Listen, if anyone ever sets fire to this city, it's going to be me.
It's an amazing opportunity. There are so many questions.
You're right there.
A phrase of Carrot's crossed Vimes's mind.
It can help us with our inquiries, he suggested.
But in the morning, said Lady Rankin firmly. Vimes's look of bitter determination faded.
"I shall sleep downstairs in the kitchen," said Lady Rankin cheerfully. "I usually have a camp bed made up down there when it's egg-laying time. Some of the females always need assistance. You don't worry about me."
"You're being very helpful," muttered Vimes.
"I've sent Nobby down to the city to help the others set up in your headquarters," said Lady Rankin.
Vimes had completely forgotten about the watch-house.
"It must have been badly damaged," he ventured.
"Totally destroyed," said Lady Rankin. "Just a patch of melted rock. So I'm letting you have the place at Pseudopolis Yard."
"Sorry?"
"Oh, my father had property all over the city," she said. "Quite useless to me, really, so I told my agent to give Sergeant Colon the keys to the house in Pseudopolis Yard. It'll do it good to be aired."
"But that area? I mean, there's real couples on the streets. The rent alone, I mean, Lord Vetinari won't—"
"Don't you worry about it," she said, giving him a friendly pat. "Now, you really ought to get some sleep."
Vimes lay in bed, his mind racing. Pseudopolis Yard was on the Ark side of the river, in quite a high-rent district. The sight of Nobby or Sergeant Colon walking down the street in daylight would probably have the same effect on the area as the opening of a plague hospital. He dozed, gliding in and out of sleep where giant dragons pursued him waving jars of ointment, and awoke to the sound of a mob. Lady Rankin drawing herself up haughtily was not a sight to forget, although you could try. It was like watching continental drift in reverse, as various subcontinents and islands pulled themselves together to form one massive angry proto-woman. The broken door of the Dragon House swung on its hinges. The inmates, already as highly strung as a harp on amphetamines, were going mad. Little gouts of flame burst against the metal plates as they stampeded back and forth in their pens.
"What," she said, "is the meaning of this?"
If a ramkin had ever been given to introspection, she'd have admitted that it wasn't a very original line. But it was handy. It did the job. The reason that clichés become clichés is that they are the hammers and the screwdrivers in the toolbox of communication. The mob filled the broken doorway. Some of it was waving various sharp implements with the up-and-down motions proper to rioters.
"Well," said the leader, "it's the dragon, innit?"
There was a chorus of muttered agreement.
"What about it?" said Lady Rankin.
"Well, it's been burning the city. They don't fly far. You've got dragons here. Could be one of them, couldn't it?" "Yeah, that's right. QED. "So what we're going to do is we're going to put them down." "That's right. Yeah. Pro bono publico."
Lady Ramkin's bosom rose and fell like an empire. She reached out and grabbed the dunging fork from its hook on the wall.
"One step nearer, I warn you, and you'll be sorry," she said.
The leader looked beyond her to the frantic dragons.
"Yeah?"
it said nastily.
"And what'll you do, eh?"
Her mouth opened and shut once or twice.
"I shall summon the watch," she said at last.
The threat did not have the effect she'd expected. Lady Ramkin had never paid much attention to those bits of the city that didn't have scales on.
"Well, that's too bad," said the leader. "That's really worrying, you know. Makes me go all weak at the knees, that does."
He extracted a lengthy cleaver from his belt.
"And now, you just stand aside, lady, because—"
A streak of green fire blasted out of the back of the shed, passed a foot over the heads of the mob, and burned a charred rosette into the woodwork over the door. Then came a voice that was a honeyed purr of sheer, deadly menace.
"This is Lord Mountjoy, Quickfang, Winterforth the Fifth. The hottest dragon in the city. It could burn your head clean off."
Captain Vimes limped forward from the shadows. A small and extremely frightened golden dragon was clamped firmly under one arm. His other hand held it by the tail. The rioters watched it, hypnotized.
"Now, I know what you're thinking," Vimes went on, softly. "You're wondering, after all this excitement, has it got enough flame yet? And you know, I ain't so sure myself."
He leaned forward, sighting between the dragon's ears, and his voice buzzed like a knife blade.
"What you've got to ask yourself is, am I feeling lucky?"
They swayed back as he advanced.
"Well," he said, "are you feeling lucky?"
For a few moments the only sound was Lord Mountjoy Quickfang Winterforth's stomach rumbling ominously as fuel sloshed in his flame chambers.
"Now look here," said the leader,
his eyes fixed hypnotically on the dragon's head.
"There's no call for anything like that.
In fact, he might just decide to flare off all by himself," said Vimes. "They have to do it to stop the gas building up. It builds up when they get nervous. And you know, I reckon you've made them all pretty nervous now."
The leader made what he hoped was a vaguely conciliatory gesture, but unfortunately did it with a hand that was still holding a knife.
"Drop it," said Vimes sharply, "or your history."
The knife clanged on the flagstones. There was a scuffle at the back of the crowd as a number of people, metaphorically speaking, were a long way away and knew nothing about it.
"But before the rest of you good citizens disperse quietly and go about your business," said Vimes meaningfully, "I suggest you take a long, hard look at these dragons. Do any of them look 60 feet long? Would you say they've got 80-foot wingspan? How hot do they flame, would you say?"
"Dunno," said the leader.
Vimes raised the dragon's head slightly. The leader rolled his eyes.
"Dunno, sir,"
he corrected.
"Do you want to find out?"
The leader shook his head, but he did manage to find his voice.
"Who are you, anyway?" he said.
Vimes drew himself up.
"Captain Vimes, City Watch," he said.
This met with almost complete silence. The exception was the cheerful voice somewhere in the back of the crowd which said,
"Night shift, is it?"
Vimes looked down at his nightshirt. In his hurry to get off his sick bed, he'd shuffled hastily into a pair of Lady Ramkin's slippers. For the first time he saw they had pink pom-poms on them. And it was at this moment that Lord Mountjoy Quickfang Winterforth chose to belch. It wasn't another stab of roaring fire. It was just a near-invisible ball of damp flame which rolled over the mob and singed a few eyebrows. But it definitely made an impression. Vimes rallied magnificently. They couldn't have noticed his brief moment of sheer horror.
"That one was just to get your attention," he said, poker-faced. "The next one will be a little lower."
Said the leader. "Right you are, no problem. We were just going anyhow. No big dragons here, right enough. Sorry you've been troubled."
"Oh, no," said Lady Ramkin triumphantly. "You don't get away that easily."
She reached up onto a shelf and produced a tin box. It had a slot in the lid. It rattled. On the side was the legend, "The Sunshine Sanctuary for Sick Dragons." The initial whip-round produced $4.31. After Captain Vimes gestured pointedly with the dragon, a further $25.16 were miraculously forthcoming. Then the mob fled.
"We made a profit on the day anyway," said Vimes when they were alone again.
"That was jolly brave of you."
"Let's just hope it doesn't catch on," said Vimes, gingerly putting the exhausted dragon back in its pen.
He felt quite light-headed. Once again he was aware of eyes staring fixedly at him. He glanced sideways into the long-pointed face of good boy Bindle Featherstone, rearing up in a pose best described as the last puppy in the shop. To his astonishment, he found himself reaching over and scratching it behind its ears, or at least behind the two spiky things at the side of his head, which were presumably its ears. It responded with a strange noise that sounded like a complicated blockage in a brewery. He took his hand away hurriedly.
"It's all right," said Lady Ramkin. "It's his stomach's rumbling. That means he likes you."
To his amazement, Vimes found that he was rather pleased about this. As far as he could recall, nothing in his life before had thought him worth a burp.
"I thought you were, going to get rid of him," he said.
"I suppose I shall have to," she said. "You know how it is, though. They look up at you with those big, soulful eyes."
There was a brief, mutual, awkward silence.
"How would it be if I—"
"You don't think you might like—"
They stopped.
"It'd be the least I could do," said Lady Ramkin.
"But you've already given us a new headquarters and everything."
"That was simply my duty as a good citizen," said Lady Ramkin. "Please accept a good boy as a friend."
Vimes felt that he was being inched out over a very deep chasm on a very thin plank.
"I don't even know what they eat," he said.
"They're omnivores, actually," she said. "They eat everything except metal and igneous rocks. You can't be finicky, you see, when you evolve in a swamp."
"But doesn't he need to be taken for walks, or flights, or whatever?"
"He seems to sleep most of the time."
She scratched the ugly thing on top of its scaly head.
"He's the most relaxed dragon I've ever bred, I must say."
What about, you know?
He indicated the dunging fork.
Well, it's mainly gas. Just keep him somewhere well ventilated. You haven't got any valuable carpets, have you? It's best not to let them lick your face, but they can be trained to control their flame. They're very helpful for lighting fires.
Good boy Bindle Featherstone curled up amidst a barrage of plumbing noises. They've got 8 stomachs, Vimes remembered. The drawings in the book had been very detailed. And there's lots of other stuff, like fractional distillation tubes and mad alchemy sets in there. No swamp dragon could ever terrorize a kingdom, except by accident. Vimes wondered how many had been killed by enterprising heroes. It was terribly cruel to do something like that to a creature whose only crime was to blow themselves absent-mindedly to pieces in mid-air, which was not something any individual dragon made a habit of. It made him quite angry to think about it. A race of whittles. That's what dragons were. Born to lose. Live fast, die wide. Omnivores or not, what they must really live on was their own nerves, flapping apologetically through the world in mortal fear of their own digestive system. The family would just be getting over father's explosion, and some twerp in a suit of armour would come plodding into the swamp to stick a sword into a bag of guts that was only one step away from self-destruction in any case. Huh. It'd be interesting to see how the great dragon slayers of the past stood up to the big dragon. Armour? Best not to wear it. It'd all be the same in any case, and at least your ashes wouldn't come pre-packaged in their own foil.
He stared and stared at the malformed little thing, and the idea that had been knocking for attention for the last few minutes finally gained entrance. Everyone in Ankh-Morpork wanted to find the dragon's lair. At least wanted to find it empty. Bits of wood on a stick wouldn't do it, he was certain. But as they said, set a thief.
Could one dragon sniff out another? I mean, follow a scent.